Education altered his state of consciousness, and in that state, he spoke about people. You could call this a sleep state. You could call it a trance state. Nobody knows what trance is. Nobody knows what sleep is, really. You could call it a self-imposed hypnotic state, if you like. All of these would be partially right. It would last about an hour. He spoke in a normal voice, his voice, no connection with spirits or entities from the other side, but clairvoyant. An ability to tune in telepathically, clairvoyantly, to the mind of the person who was asking his help. Stenographers, Gladys from 1923 on, recorded in detail everything that he said. And so Eddie Casey gradually became famous as he worked first in the medical field, and doctors followed his suggestions for their patients and got help. Dad did no healing himself at all. He simply gave information which could be followed, and people got well. He did this for 43 years, every day, practically every day.
I heard him so many times tell people, new people who would come to him seeking a reading, many times he would tell a person, I don't know what this is, but for the good that's come to me and mine, I have to try to help whenever I'm asked. I don't know whether I can get another reading or not. I mean, I never know when I lie down whether I'm going to be able to even get to sleep or whether anything is going to be said when I am asleep. But I can tell you this, if you find anything in this reading that is harmful, I'll never give another. He was never challenged on that.
The voices you just heard are recordings of Edgar Casey's son, Hugh Lynn Casey, and Gladys Davis, the stenographer who took down verbatim the words spoken by Edgar Casey during literally thousands of his psychic readings. These voice recordings are from the archives of the Edgar Casey Foundation. Interspersed throughout side one of this tape, you will hear Hugh Lynn Casey and Gladys Davis commenting on various aspects of Edgar Casey's life and work. The excerpts we've selected were recorded at many different times and locations, and therefore the quality of the recordings tends to vary. However, we feel that the inclusion of such rare personal observations by two of the people who were closest to Edgar Casey more than makes up for the sometimes less than perfect audio quality. Edgar Casey was born near Hopkinsville, Kentucky, on March 18, 1877, and had a normal childhood in most respects, one rich with the heritage of 19th century farm life. He was one of five children, surrounded by a large family which included his parents and grandparents, with uncles, aunts, and cousins. Like many children, he had imaginary playmates. At the age of six, he told his parents that he could sometimes see and talk to visions.
He was a strange little boy and had peculiar experiences even as a child of six or seven. He began to tell his parents about the energy patterns or auras that he saw. And he talked later, after his grandfather's death, of talking with his grandfather after he died. Though Dad wasn't a medium, in this sense, he did have communication as a little child.
For the most part, his family attributed these experiences to his overactive imagination and paid them little attention. He found comfort in reading the Bible and decided to read it from cover to cover once through for every year of his life.
I'll tell you about that, how it started, according to his story, that he dictated to me of his early years. He was a little boy, and I guess around 10 or even earlier, there was a black man who was working around the place, and he would play with him, you know, out in the yard and around the farm, and he would kept talking to him about being as strong as Samson. And Edgar Casey wanted to know who Samson was. He hadn't heard about him, so he was telling him about the Bible, and so he asked his mother if he could read the story in the Bible, and he got in the Bible, he started reading. And then he was fascinated by the story of Samson, and he read more and more. And someone in the family, I've forgotten who it was, gave him a special Bible. He had many Bibles given to him through the years. But he read the Bible through in his Sunday school lesson. They had a notation that if you read three chapters each day and five on Sunday, you could read it through in a year.
Mm-hmm.
So he started doing that, and he and then he thought, well, if he would read more chapters, he could catch up in the back year so that he would catch up to his age.
At the age of 13, he claimed to have a vision which would influence him for the rest of his life. A beautiful woman appeared to him, and he told her that more than anything, he wanted to help others, especially children, when they were sick. Shortly after the experience, Edgar displayed a talent that could no longer be explained by his family in terms of the boy's imagination. Edgar could sleep on his school books and acquire a photographic memory of their entire contents.
He had a very difficult block of memory and couldn't remember anything that he had studied. One night, while working with his father trying to learn a spelling lesson, he asked his father to let him go to sleep for a little while. He thought he could get a little rest and he'd be all right. And he said, go to sleep. Now, he may have hypnotized him at that time. We don't know. But when Edgar Cayce awakened after about 10 minutes, he knew everything that he had studied in the spelling book and could repeat it easily and remembered everything. From then on, up till 6 to 7 grades in a country school, he moved very rapidly because he would go to sleep on his books and remember, be able to recall everything that he had studied. They began to call him Sleeping Cayce then and laughed at him.
Upon awakening, he could repeat back word for word any length of material, even if it contained words which were far beyond his limited education. The gift faded, however, and Edgar was only able to complete the 9th grade before having to get a job to help support his family. At the age of 16, he moved with his family to Hopkinsville, got a job at a dry goods firm, and later at a bookstore. It was while he was working at the bookstore on Main Street that he met and fell in love with a young woman named Gertrude Evans. They became engaged 4 days before his 20th birthday, and Edgar decided they would marry when he was better able to financially support a family. For that reason, he moved to Louisville and became a traveling salesman. It was now 1900, and he seemed to be doing quite well, selling stationery and insurance. He became confident that it wouldn't be long before he could afford to get married. However, at the age of 23, after taking a sedative prescribed by a doctor for a cold, Cayce developed a severe case of laryngitis. He wasn't really concerned at first. After all, many people lose their voice for a day or two. But the condition persisted. Doctors were called in, and later specialists. But still, Edgar was unable to speak above a whisper. As the days turned into weeks, he was forced to give up his job as a salesman and look for something he could do that didn't require much speaking. He found the perfect job as a photographer's assistant. At this turn-of-the-century time, hypnotism and stage shows were experiencing a renewed interest in this country. One showman, who called himself Hart, the Laugh Man, brought his comedy and hypnotism act to the Hopkinsville Opera House. Edgar Cayce happened to go to the show. It was now approaching 1 year since his laryngitis had begun, and he volunteered as one of Hart's subjects. Unfortunately, it turned out that Edgar was one of those people who couldn't be hypnotized, but he offered to put himself to sleep, much as he had done when he'd slept on his school books. While Cayce was in his self-induced sleep state, Hart spoke to him and told him that he would be able to regain his voice. To the amazement of everyone who knew Edgar and how the young man was only able to speak in a whisper, Cayce responded to questions in his normal voice while in the trance state. However, a post-hypnotic suggestion did not work, and his laryngitis returned when Hart woke him up. The next time hypnotism was suggested, it was with a different twist. A local man was found to give the suggestions, and Edgar Cayce consented to one further test. The local man, Al Lane, had educated himself. Not only had he worked with hypnotism, but he was quite familiar with osteopathy as well. The test they tried was simple. As before, Edgar put himself to sleep. Only this time, instead of suggesting that the young man's voice return, Lane asked Cayce to explain what was wrong with him and how he could be cured, and Cayce spoke back. While asleep on the couch, Cayce described the cause as, quote, a psychological condition producing a physical effect, unquote. He went on to say the problem could be removed by suggesting to him, while he was in the unconscious state, that the blood circulation increase to the affected areas. Lane made the suggestion, and he and Casey's family watched in amazement as the upper part of Casey's chest and throat turned a bright crimson red, and the skin became warm to the touch. After the suggestion was made that the blood circulation returned to normal and Casey was awakened, his voice had returned to him. He was able to speak like himself again. The laryngitis that had lasted nearly an entire year was gone. The date, March 31st, 1901, marked the first time Edgar Casey gave a reading. For years, Al Lane had been bothered by a stomach difficulty that doctors had been unable to cure. He convinced Edgar to try giving him a reading on the stomach problem. With a great deal of reluctance, for Casey only wanted to live a normal life in Hopkinsville, Edgar finally agreed. He felt obligated to Lane for having helped him regain his voice. Asleep on the couch, Casey spoke in a normal voice and described the problem exactly. He recommended herbal medicines, foods, and exercises for improvement. After 1 week of following the sleeping Casey's suggestions, Lane felt so much better that he became even more excited than ever before about Edgar's ability. He convinced Casey that the talent was not to be overlooked, and he strongly encouraged that they try other tests. One of the earliest readings was for a 5-year-old named Amy Dietrich, who had been seriously ill for 3 years. At the age of 2, after an attack of influenza, her mind had stopped developing beyond that of a 2-year-old. Since that time, her tiny body had been racked with convulsions. Her mind was nearly a blank, and though doctors and specialists had been consulted, she'd only gotten worse instead of better. Edgar put himself into his special sleep state, while Lane conducted the reading and wrote down everything that was said. The sleeping Casey said that Amy's problem had begun a few days before catching influenza. She'd fallen and injured her spine while getting down from a carriage. The influenza virus had settled in her spine because of the trauma, and the convulsions had begun. Later, the little girl's mother verified the accident. While still sleeping, Edgar Casey recommended certain osteopathic adjustments that were to be carried out by Lane. Soon after this reading, Lane made the adjustments on the little girl's spine and got another reading. This time, the sleeping Casey told Lane he hadn't done them correctly and gave further instructions. After several attempts, Lane was able to carry out the suggestions to the exact specifications. Several days later, Amy began to show signs of improvement. First, she recognized the doll she'd played with several years ago and called it by name. As the weeks passed, she recognized other things as well. She knew her parents, and best of all, the convulsions stopped completely. Within 3 months, Amy's mind was catching up to where it had left off, and she became a normal, healthy girl who by the age of 7 had caught up with other children her age. It was soon discovered that Edgar only needed the name and location of an individual to be able to give a reading, diagnose their condition, and outline a regimen of treatment. Edgar continued giving readings without charge, while Lane served as a facilitator or conductor of each reading. But most of Casey's time was spent as a photographer. In 1903, after an engagement of more than 6 years, Gertrude Evans and Edgar Casey were finally married. In spite of his being uncomfortable with the readings, Edgar's life was fulfilling. He had a loving wife, a home, Sunday school classes at the local church, and a good job. A year later, he formed his own photographic partnership and was able to open a studio. A local MD named Wesley Ketchum had heard of Casey through some of Lane's former patients. Dr. Ketchum decided to get a reading for himself. Ketchum had recently diagnosed himself as having appendicitis, and he wanted to see if Casey would be able to pick up on it. However, while asleep, Edgar gave an entirely different diagnosis and outlined a simple treatment. In order to humor the young man, Dr. Ketchum went to another doctor for a third opinion and discovered that Casey's diagnosis was indeed correct. Wesley Ketchum ended up using Casey's psychic talent in over 100 of his most difficult cases. In one instance, a wealthy construction supervisor, whose name was Mr. Dalton, severely fractured his leg and kneecap in an accident. He was told by several doctors in town that they could not set the leg because of the seriousness of the injury. He might never be able to walk again because his kneecap seemed damaged beyond repair. Not satisfied with their reports, Dalton consulted Dr. Ketchum. At Ketchum's request, Casey gave a reading and recommended what was extremely unorthodox treatment. Ketchum was to drive several nails into the kneecap to hold it in place while the leg healed. The procedure was unheard of at the time, but Dr. Ketchum, trusting in Casey, carried it out. The procedure was performed, and several months later, Dalton was up and walking around as though the accident had never occurred. Edgar Casey's fame continued to spread. In 1910, the New York Times picked up an article that Dr. Wesley Ketchum had written for the Medical Society of Boston, calling Casey a medical wonder.
The New York Times, on October the 9th, 1910, carried double-page headlines and pictures of Edgar Casey, illiterate farmer boy becomes doctor when asleep, and from that time on, people came asking him to go to sleep and talk about them. They didn't have to be present. He could do this at a distance, and he became famous as a man who could sleep and diagnose, use clairvoyance, telepathy. He did this for the next 43 years.
Because the requests for readings continued to grow, that same year he formed a partnership with three others, including his father and Dr. Ketchum, and began in his spare time to give readings on a daily basis. He and Gertrude had their first son, Hugh Lynn, in 1907. In 1911, Gertrude gave birth to their second, whom they named Milton Porter. Soon after his birth, the baby developed whooping cough and later colitis. Several doctors were called, but the baby continued to worsen. Edgar never really thought about consulting the readings until the doctors had given up hope. As a last resort, Casey gave a reading for his second son. When he woke up, he was shattered to learn that the condition was too far gone. The readings offered no hope, and the baby died before it was 2 months old. Afterwards, Edgar and his wife both entered a state of depression. He blamed himself for not getting a reading sooner. Perhaps it might have helped. Now he would never know. Gertrude was completely saddened and began to lose her health. She became weak after the baby's death, until the doctor thought she had contracted pleurisy. But as the months continued to pass, the illness hung on, and she showed no signs of improvement. In fact, she was getting worse, and was eventually confined to bed in her weakened condition. By late summer, Gertrude's doctor had changed his diagnosis. He called Edgar aside and spoke the awful truth. Gertrude had tuberculosis and was dying. A TB specialist confirmed there was nothing further that could be done. Everyone expected her to die by the end of the year, except for her husband, who decided to give a reading. While in the sleep state, Edgar Casey recommended a combination of prescription drugs as well as a charred oak keg filled with apple brandy. Gertrude was to inhale the fumes to clear up the congestion. Although the doctors claimed that the combination of drugs would be useless, Dr. Ketchum wrote the prescription. Within 2 days after taking the drug, Gertrude's fever had fallen. By September, she was a little better. And by November, even her doctors decided she was going to get well. By the first part of January 1912, Gertrude Casey was almost fully recovered. That same year, Edgar Casey was investigated by a professor from Harvard University and was able to demonstrate the legitimacy and the effectiveness of his readings. He was helping people and had come to accept his unusual talent as part of his life as a photographer, but his fame as a psychic was growing. He moved with his family to Selma, Alabama to open a photography studio and began to live a quiet life without notoriety. However, one day his son, Hugh Lynn, was playing with flash powder in the studio and severely burned his eyes. The local doctors gave no hope that the boy would ever see again. In fact, they recommended removing one of his eyes due to the extent of the damage.
The local paper carried an announcement of my blowing up a whole box of flashlight powder in my face. It burned me horribly. And the doctors thought they were going to have to take out an eye. And I can remember our family physician, Dr. Gay, sitting by my bed and telling me they thought they were going to have to operate, that their eyes were not healing. And Dad, then I asked my father to give this information, psychic information. They changed the diet, the medicine, and the packs on the eyes, and they healed. And so when I got my sight back after being blind for a number of months, actually, I practically worshipped Edgar Casey.
Local newspapers carried the story, and all over again, Edgar Casey was famous. He began giving readings in Selma in addition to his job. Like every other city he'd lived in, he became active in the local church and started teaching Sunday school and picked up where he'd left off. He and his wife now had two sons, for Gertrude had given birth to another child, Edgar Evans. His Sunday school classes became the most popular in the county, for Edgar had the ability to make the Bible come alive. He hired a secretary, Gladys Davis, to take down the information in the readings.
This was in the summer. It was in August 1923, and all the stores in Selma would close on Thursday afternoon through the summer. But Miss Graham asked me if I would go with her to take down a reading she was having for her little afflicted nephew. So I hesitated, but finally I decided I'd do it. So I went with her, and he met us at the top of the steps, and he took us in this little room, which was back of his dark room, and there were other people sitting there in the room, and he had a little cot that he sat on first and talked to us, and then lay down and started with the reading. He talked to us a while, and then he put his hands the back of his head like this, you know, and lay there a few minutes just looking at the ceiling. And then he moved his hands down across the solar plexus this way, and I found out later, I mean, this was the procedure through the years. When his eyes began to flutter, you know, sort of like that, right? Then Mr. LB, who conducted the reading, his father, would start to talk to him, give him the suggestion, and he would started breathing like this. His chest would go up and down like this, you know, sort of. His chest would rise like that, and then in a few minutes Mr. LB gave him the suggestion for this boy and his address, where he was and everything, and he said, yes, we have the body, and started on reading. So then Miss Graham told me that I was to make two copies of it, and so I came on back to work Friday morning, and a girlfriend down the street, I read my notes to her, and she helped me with the spelling of some of the words I'd never heard of, like dorsals and cervicals. And at lunchtime, she took the copies up to Mr. Casey, I mean, one copy up to him. And when she came back from lunch, she came in and said, Mr. Casey told me to ask you to think about coming to work for him, and if you're interested, come up and see him. And she says, I think you should do it. And so I never had a doubt. I knew I wanted to do it. So it was 2 weeks later that I went to work for him on September 10th, 1923. And he said to me one of the first things, now Miss Gladys, he always called me Miss Gladys, not just Gladys, Miss Gladys. Remember, you'll be working with me, not for me.
Until 1923, virtually all of Casey's readings were limited to health diagnoses and recommended treatments. However, that year, a wealthy printer from Dayton, who had obtained successful readings for two of his nieces, asked Casey for a horoscope reading. The novel request was granted, and toward the end of the reading, Edgar offered this curious sentence, quote, he was once a monk, unquote. That statement opened the door to a whole new area of research, because the reference was to the possibility of reincarnation. Casey was now faced with a new dilemma. There wasn't any doubt that the information was helpful and accurate when dealing with health issues, but the reading's matter-of-fact reference to reincarnation seemed foreign to his fundamental Christianity. He prayed about it, did much soul-searching, and obtained further readings on the topic. he was advised to read the Bible once through from cover to cover while keeping the idea of reincarnation in mind. What emerged for him was a beautiful view of oneness that encompassed all of the world's major religions, although Casey continued to feel that his own special emphasis was Judeo-Christian. The philosophy that began to emerge from his readings was that life is a purposeful and an eternal experience. Everything that exists is part of God. Each of us is one of God's children, and we are equal. We have free will to learn to love one another. Edgar Casey found the concept of reincarnation was not incompatible with any religion, but more importantly, he found that the idea merged comfortably with his own beliefs of what it meant to be a Christian.
I remember a reading that said that if this information through the readings in the study group work or in any of the information in the readings doesn't make you a better church member, a better citizen, a better father, mother, sister, brother, and so on, doesn't make you a better person, then you should forget it. He didn't say that you should belong to this church or that church or the other. You worship God in your own chosen church.
Soon afterwards, a new type of reading became available to those who were interested. They were called life readings, and dealt with an individual's past in other lifetimes, as well as the person's potential for this lifetime. Over the years, approximately 2,500 life readings were given. Eventually, the topics in the readings expanded to include such things as mental and spiritual counsel, unusual approaches to the studies of psychology and parapsychology, information on the world's history, intriguing thoughts about the missing years of Jesus not accounted for in the Bible, and advice for improving personal relationships. However, even after 1923, the physical health readings continued to account for about two-thirds of his psychic work. Just what was the source of Edgar Casey's remarkable ability, an ability he claimed anyone could develop?
He said that he got this from the mind of the person whose physical condition he was reading for, and then from the world of thought form. He drew and selected what, in his opinion, would fit this person the best. He said, and he gave 2,500 readings on this following this question, he said that in previous incarnations in the earth, he had lived before, that he had developed psychic ability in other experiences and was using this talent, this ability, in the present. That he had developed a healing center in old Persia, outside of Shusta, Iran. We're very interested in the archaeological, the digging, that site to find. He says it will be discovered, this city that he worked in as a healer way back in the thousands of B.C. He developed this ability and brought it over into the present and was actually using a gift. He felt that it was a gift that God had given him, as he gives many people gifts, which he could use to serve his fellow man.
Apparently, Casey obtained his information in two different ways. In the first, he was somehow able to tap into the subconscious mind of the person who was asking for information. And the second way was from what he called the Akashic Records, a record Casey said was written on the skein of space and time and could also be called God's Book of Remembrance. From these two places, he was able to speak knowledgeably on just about any subject.
He'd come in from the garden or from fishing off of his pier and loosen his collar, tie, lie on a couch, and put his hands up over his head for a few moments. Then he said if he saw a white light flash that no one else saw it, he'd cross his hands over his solar plexus. The stenographer would take pencil and paper. My mother would sit by him. His eyelids would flutter. They'd give him a suggestion. You'll be in touch with so-and-so and so-and-so at such-and-such an address. And he would begin to describe sometimes what the person was doing and then the details of their physical body. It was a very convincing kind of clairvoyance and telepathy. He was not a medium, though, in the sense of having guides or controls. Yeah. We never heard any voice speaking through him, never heard any doctors talking through him or anything of that kind. It was his own unconscious making contact, he said, with the person who had asked him for help.
Two or three times this happened. During a reading, he would be giving information and he would read my mind. For instance, once I couldn't interrupt him and say, how do you spell that, or you know, I missed something. But he went along in a sentence with a long this and that, a lot of words, and I thought, well, do I put a dash between these or, you know, a comma? And I usually had to do it in shorthand so I would know when I typed it up. I tried to understand what he was saying so I could punctuate it correctly. And so I was going through my mind, and he interrupted himself and said, put a comma between these. Over there on the couch with his eyes closed, you know.
A woman wrote to Edgar Casey from Raleigh, North Carolina, 300 miles away from Virginia Beach. She didn't ask any questions. She just said, I've been sick for some time. Would you give me a reading? The reading described 11 different symptoms, which the doctor could check. She took this reading to a doctor, and he checked the symptom. A rash on the inside of her left hand. Congestion in the nasal passages of the throat. A tilted stomach, which he said if they would index, they would find it tilted in a particular way. He listed 11 symptoms which could be checked. We have letters from doctors confirming that diagnosis, that he treated the person according to the reading, and she got well, and he wrote us about that, the results of the treatment.
Mr. Harry Getz tells this story about this man who, in England, who had, Mr. Getz had influenced him to get a reading, and he agreed to sit with him while he had the appointment. So they were sitting there. We didn't know this until later, but when the reading started, it said, good hand. And we had no idea what it meant. But later, as Mr. Getz said, they were playing bridge, and he did have a
very good hand. You made a note on the exact time the reading started. And when they got it, he had been playing a grand slam at clubs. And now, I told that story on the David Frost show, and Frost threw up his hands. He said, this is hard to believe. This is just hard to believe. And Getz wrote to David Frost, and he happened to know him, and confirmed that story that I told, and Frost admitted it to me later on another show.
He was a witness of it.
He was a witness. He was there. He saw this happen.
Remember the beginning of a reading he mentioned... he was going back over the birth date, and often he would do that. He would start with the present day and go right on back to the birth date, and sometimes he would remark on the changes that took place during a certain year.
Yeah.
So, but this time he got all the way back to the birth date, and he said, not a very nice day, is it?
Uh-huh.
About a year or two after Mr. Casey died, when we were busy trying to get reports in on these last readings that were given, I've decided to write to the Weather Bureau in this place where the man was born. They gave the temperature and everything, and how the wind, at a certain time, the wind switched. It was going lickety-split in one direction. All of a sudden, it changed right in the other direction, started going back.
Do you remember the one that he gave for the man, and he was going back over his, at the beginning when he was born, and coming forward, and said, Nabisco.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the man wrote us, we didn't understand what Nabisco was about, but the man wrote us.
His wife wrote us.
Yeah, almost laughing about it. He said when he was a kid, they began to call him, his name wasn't Nabisco at all, but they began to call him Nabisco because he ate so many Nabisco wafers. And he had had this nickname, and the nickname had stuck with him over a period of time, and those were the years where they began to call him Nabisco. Gladys, in the readings themselves, you saw a lot of the examples, more than I did, really, of the dad giving a reading for somebody who had requested it, but the request hadn't gotten to us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you remember, could you give us an example of one or two of those?
Yes.
They're very unusual.
Mr. Casey was giving a reading before a group of people, and Morton Blumenthal had just become interested, and he had, there were several spiritualists there, and anyway, it was a physical diagnosis. At the end of this reading, he started in on another person. He says, now we have Clara Inlow of... so-and-so, Missouri. He was saying that she should go and have an operation, have the surgery. It was important for her to have this surgery. When we got to Dayton, there was a letter waiting for us there, asking for the reading.
And she was asking the question, as I remember, should I have had an operation?
Yeah, she didn't know. The doctors had advised it, but she wasn't. She didn't know whether it was right. She wanted him to, in this case, to tell her in the reading, and then she would have confidence to go ahead with it.
So he had picked this up at a distance. There were lots of examples of that through the years. You remember, you and I were present in the Kahn home in New York on one occasion, where he gave 2 or 3 readings, voluntary readings, that the letters were in the mail, and didn't arrive until we got back to Virginia Beach. In that case, he pulled, I think, one of the most amazing telepathic and clairvoyant stunts I've ever seen him do, Gladys, and you've heard me tell this too, in the Willard Hotel in Washington. We were going in there one day for breakfast into the coffee shop, and this lady was standing in the door to the Willard pulling on some white gloves, and he walked on past her, walked into the coffee shop, turned around, walked right back out again, and stopped right in front of her, and said, "Madam, if I were you, I wouldn't get in an automobile for the next 24 hours. And her mouth dropped open, and she stopped doing her gloves, and he turned around and walked on in. Now, I couldn't get him to tell me what he saw. He just refused to, just don't talk about it. Don't want to talk about it, won't discuss it. Well, we finished breakfast, went along. The next morning, we went down for breakfast again, and we were sitting eating, and I saw this woman suddenly coming through the door, and she was hysterical. She was crying, and she was looking wild, starry-eyed, all over the place. I knew she was looking for him, and she came rushing across to the table, and I got up, tried to stop her, and she brushed me aside, just like I wasn't there, and grabbed a hold of him, caught a hold of him. He didn't even get up, and said, "I want to thank you, I want to thank you." And she had a crumpled telegram in her hand. Within an hour after we had seen her the day before, she had been asked by her sister-in-law to go on a drive down the Skyline Drive with her. And on the strength of Dad's comment, she had said no. And the telegram that she had gotten later that day, there had been an accident on the Skyline Drive. This woman had gone off the drive. The car had been demolished. The woman hadn't been hurt too bad, but the woman she had got to go with her had had her hip broken. He was remarkable in a bewildering variety of ways.
Because the requests for readings continued to grow, Casey gave up his photography studio and began looking for the financial backing to build a hospital. He began to accept donations for the readings, but he never refused to help those who were unable to pay. Finally, a New York businessman agreed to finance the project, and in 1925, the Casey family and Secretary Gladys Davis moved to Virginia Beach. An organization of supporters formed in 1927, and the following year, the Edgar Casey Hospital was built and opened its doors. Until 1931, the hospital operated successfully, but in the midst of the Depression, financial backing was dropped, and the building had to close its doors along with a small university that had been organized by the same group of supporters. But from the remains of the failed first organization, a new one emerged later that year. The Association for Research and Enlightenment, Incorporated. The ARE was formed as a research body whose goal was to investigate the information given by Casey in the readings. The group was interested in such things as holistic health care, the workings of ESP, meditation, spiritual healing, the importance of dreams, and the study of life after death. As Edgar Casey's fame grew, so too did the number of skeptics.
Many investigators of psychic phenomena questioned him during the years of his life. Many medical authorities, of course, but doctors began to cooperate with him, testing him, trying him out. And so individual doctors became convinced, and there were dozens of these during his lifetime who worked with him. But many were critical, of course. Dad was laughed at, scoffed at, was in jail once for practicing medicine without a license. He never made money out of it. He worked for a very small salary for the Psychical Research Society after 1923.
Many people came to Virginia Beach to expose him as a fraud. But in time, most all were convinced of the legitimacy of what he was doing. Many ended up staying in Virginia Beach and got readings for themselves. One writer of strict Catholic background named Thomas Chagru came to Virginia Beach to investigate what he thought had to be craziness. He ended up writing There Is a River, Edgar Casey's biography, which was published in 1942. Coronet magazine, one of the most popular of the era, sent a reporter to investigate. The article, written by Marguerite Harmon Brough, was entitled Miracle Man of Virginia Beach, and it drew widespread attention. Edgar Cayce became more famous than he had ever been before. During the height of World War II, sacks of mail were delivered daily to Cayce with ever-growing requests for readings. Despite the readings' warning that he should give no more than two a day, Edgar began giving as many as eight a day in an effort to keep up. Finally, he collapsed from sheer exhaustion, and just as he'd given his first reading for himself, he gave his last reading for himself. It was September 1944. The reading told him that he had to rest. When Gertrude asked how long, the response was, until he was well or dead. Shortly afterward, he had a stroke and became partially paralyzed. By the end of the year, his friends feared the worst.
Well, Edgar Cayce died on January 3rd, 1945. For the 4 months before that, from the last of August through the end of the year, he was ill and unable to give readings. Except one was given on himself in September, on September 17th. Well, when he died, we had appointments 2 years in advance for readings. We had about $30,000 advanced fees that had to be returned, and some of the people stayed on as members, but very few of them. We ended up with about 300 tried and true people who were comprised our membership.
Gladys Davis took it upon herself to preserve the information she'd taken such great pains to record. After Edgar's sons returned from the war, she eventually took charge of the project to catalog and index all of the 14,256 readings. Hugh Lynn took over the organization his father had started and was able to encourage interest all over the world. Although no psychic was chosen to take Edgar Cayce's place, the ARE continued and began to grow dramatically, especially in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Even though people were no longer able to get personal readings, thousands of them found that they received good results from applying universal principles found in Edgar Cayce's readings. Gladys finished indexing the readings in 1971, more than a quarter century after Cayce died. After the indexing, she found that the readings mentioned more than 10,000 different subjects. Nearly every question imaginable had been asked. Today, several organizations work with the information contained in the Edgar Cayce readings. The ARE continues to make the material more readily available in practical presentations and publications, and members throughout the world are kept updated on developments into the things Cayce spoke about. The Edgar Cayce Foundation spends time and resources sponsoring comparative studies which include the Cayce information and sponsoring research. Atlantic University, which closed in 1931, was reactivated in 1985 with its offering of academic studies into holistic health, altered consciousness, and ESP. The ARE Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona, researches the medical information contained in the readings and incorporates the material with contemporary medical knowledge. Together, these organizations have shown that the psychic information of the photographer from Kentucky has stood the test of intensive research for as long as 75 years.
I think all people, according to Edgar Cayce, they have psychic ability. And it's like anything else. If you work with it, if you try to develop it, for example, through dreams, working with your dreams is an excellent way of developing your own psychic capacity. Or if you work with meditation. Or in some instances, some people working with hypnosis can increase their psychic sensitivity. Edgar Cayce was just someone who could play Chopin, so to speak, psychically, instead of chopsticks.
The majority of Edgar Cayce's readings deal with health maintenance and the treatment of illness. And yet this material, which numbers nearly 9,000 readings, is not limited to concerns about the physical body alone. Even critics of other parts of Cayce's work will agree that the information on health offers important insights into how each of us can stay well. The readings make recommendations for everything from acne, diet, hemorrhoids, longevity, and warts, to arthritis, cancer, epilepsy, mental illness, and psoriasis. Nearly every condition that existed between the turn of the century and 1945, whether it's childbirth, fractures, or vitamin deficiency, is represented in the files of the Casey material. Interestingly enough, modern-day researchers have found that many of the recommended treatments given decades ago by the sleeping photographer to specific individuals seem to be applicable on a much wider scale. The information on psoriasis and scleroderma are two of the most important and notable examples. For both of these, the Casey treatment regimens involve specific diet changes, particular spinal adjustments, and other natural remedy procedures. In recent years, hundreds of people with these two ailments have been helped by following the same program. Edgar Casey saw total health as involving coordination between the physical, mental, and spiritual components of our lives. We need to consider our entire being for any complete approach to health. Because of this idea from the readings, it has been said that the beginnings of present-day holistic health started in 1877 with the birth of Edgar Casey. The readings for people asking for physical help were given much like the others. Casey would put himself to sleep on his couch, while his secretary, Gladys Davis, sat nearby with her steno pad and prepared to write down everything that was said. The person conducting the reading, usually Casey's wife, Gertrude, would give him the proper suggestion for obtaining the information they needed. For physical readings, it went like this. You will have before you the body of... Gertrude would then say the person's name. Who was located at, she'd then say their city and address. You will go over the body carefully, examine it thoroughly, and tell me the conditions you find at the present time, giving the cause of the existing conditions, also the suggestions for the help and relief of this body. You will speak distinctly at a normal rate of speech. You will answer the questions that may be asked. Then, while he was sleeping, Casey would generally respond, "Yes, we have the body here." If he'd ever given a reading for the person before, he would add, "This we have had before." Even if the individual's last reading had been 30 years earlier, Casey would pick right up where he'd left off, as if no time had passed. He spoke in his own voice and referred to the person as if they were in the same room, even though Casey was in Virginia Beach and the patient could be more than 1,000 miles away. He would then give a general description of the condition and include information about the blood supply, the nerve system, and the organs involved in the difficulty. Finally, he would outline detailed methods to bring about relief and respond to questions as they were asked. If the person getting the readings was in the room with Casey, it was found that they only needed to think a question, and he could answer it. Casey's readings saw that it required a skillful blending of the physician's training and knowledge, along with the patient's own attitudes and beliefs, to bring about an awareness of healing. Ultimately, the physician must attempt to stimulate the healing forces which are within the patient, but there are a variety of methods available to the holistic physician. For a patient who expects that only medication or a pill will bring about healing, such a treatment will work best. For another patient, a different set of beliefs and expectations may make spinal adjustments, massage, or even surgery the best course to follow. The point is for the holistic physician to treat the entire body, mind, and spirit in whatever technique is used. It should be emphasized, however, that Casey never provided magic formulas or cures. While it is true that miracles of healing can happen, the readings usually recommend an overall regimen of therapies involving the whole system. Casey was not a psychic healer. He claimed no special power. Instead, he gave psychic counseling for total health that instructed people in what they could do best to bring about their own healing. It took a lot of effort. Often when someone requested medical assistance for a condition, their reading from Casey would respond with, "Why do you want to get well?" In other words, if it was simply to return to the same lifestyle that had led to the sickness in the first place, then the patient was simply looking for ways to alleviate their symptoms instead of getting to the real heart of the illness. It would be like someone taking an aspirin every day for a headache caused by too much coffee instead of trying to cut down on their intake of caffeine. As one reading put it, quote, "Thus, if one would correct physical or mental disturbances, it is necessary to change the attitude and to let the life force become constructive and not destructive. Hate, malice, and jealousy only create poisons within the minds, souls, and bodies of people." Unquote. The major components of the reading's approach to wellness has been incorporated into the acronym CARE, C-A-R-E, which stands for circulation, assimilation, relaxation, and elimination. Without proper circulation, the body's ability to heal itself is severely impaired. The natural healing process is bolstered by facilitating the blood circulation through exercise, massage, and manipulative therapies such as osteopathic adjustments. This principle is clearly stated in this way, quote, "There is not condition existent in a body that the reflection of same may not be traced in the blood supply. For not only does the bloodstream carry the rebuilding forces to the body, it also takes the used forces and eliminates same through their proper channels in the various portions of the system." Unquote. In the same reading given in 1927, Casey stated that, quote, "The day may yet arrive when one may take a drop of blood and diagnose the condition of any physical body," unquote. And today, this is considered commonplace. Assimilation is the second key word. It is the body's ability to digest and distribute food. One aspect of assimilation takes into account an individual's diet, which the reading suggests should consist of 20% acid to 80% alkaline-producing foods, as well as 8 glasses of water daily. But assimilation is also influenced by the methods in which our foods are prepared and the ways in which we combine them. For example, although both grain cereals and citrus fruits are to be included in a healthful diet, they are never to be eaten during the same meal. The third key word in the acronym CARE is relaxation, which includes not only getting enough sleep, but also setting time aside for the purpose of recreation. Casey said to one person, quote, "These conditions arose as a result of what might be called occupational disturbances. Not enough time in the sun, not enough hard work. Plenty of brain work, true. But the body is supposed to coordinate the spiritual, mental, and the physical. He who does not give recreation a place in his life and the proper tone to each of the phases, well, he just fools himself. Someday, he pays the price." Unquote. The final key word is elimination. Proper eliminations are necessary for the body to rid itself of toxins, cleanse the internal organs, and to function normally. Long before people were joking about their regularity, Casey advised individuals not to let a day pass without having thrown off their waste products. Ways to do this would be with such things as proper diet, exercises such as walking, sweat baths, correct breathing, and plenty of water. These four things, working in cooperation with each other, can promote healing and longevity. The reading's approach to holistic healing is one whereby the physical body is brought into attunement or alignment with the mental and spiritual sides of our being. The principle is that we are spiritual beings with mental attitudes and emotions. Any approach to healing that fails to take this into account will not be complete. Just as every cell has a pattern for wholeness and health within itself, there is a pattern within every system of the body for proper functioning, as well as the proper relationship it has as an integral part of the whole. In essence, Casey's approach to health can be summed up in the following reading, quote, "Spirit is the life, mind is the builder, and the physical is the result," unquote. Second only to the readings on health, the next largest number of Edgar Casey readings deal with the possibility of reincarnation. He gave almost 2,500 past life readings. Although it wasn't until 1923 that readings were specifically given on the subject of reincarnation, the concept had been mentioned in the health readings as early as 1911. Casey and his family just hadn't understood the references. Just what is reincarnation? It is the belief that each of us goes through a series of lifetimes for the purpose of spiritual growth and soul development. Casey's approach does not include transmigration, which is a related theory and states that it's possible for human beings to be born again as animals. From the standpoint of the Casey material, souls have occupied only human bodies throughout the course of time. When an individual dies, the next lifetime does not take place immediately. The soul is given a chance to take stock of all it has come to know, and then has the opportunity to decide for itself what lessons it needs to learn next in order to become a more complete individual. The soul chooses to be born again into the earth, generally among people it has known before. A soul can choose to be born into either a male or a female body in any given lifetime, or as Casey often called it, an incarnation. The choices made are so that the soul might best fulfill that specific purpose chosen for that particular lifetime. A soul selects those parents and families, locations and time periods which will best allow for the learning of lessons it needs for completeness. The goal is to fully express love in all the challenges which physical life offers. Our experiences are subject to the choices we have made with our own free will. As we grow, we learn, or rather remember, that we are children of God and our rightful place is with God. The readings put it like this, quote, "It is not by chance that each entity enters, but that the entity, as part of the whole, may fill that place which no other soul may fill so well, and thus glorify Him, God, in the entity's relationship to others in any and every experience." Unquote. With free will, we can turn the challenges life presented to us into stepping stones toward growth, or we can see them as obstacles and stumbling blocks. Either way, we reap what we have sown. We constantly meet the consequences of previous deeds and attitudes. There's the story of a woman who came to Edgar Casey at the age of 45 for a life reading. 9 years earlier, she'd been completely paralyzed and now was totally dependent on other people to help her get around. In her reading, Casey said that the cause of her affliction was linked to a life she had lived at the time of the Roman Emperor Nero. She'd been a member of the nobility and an associate of the emperor. Apparently, she found it quite entertaining to go to the arena and watch the Christians persecuted by gladiators and wild animals. Her reading states, quote, "And the entity laughed at those who were crippled in the arena. And lo, that selfsame thing returns to you." Unquote. Now, this certainly doesn't mean that all of our problems, our illnesses, and our shortcomings are because of some past life that we don't even remember on a conscious level. Instead, it's merely to remind us that we've got to start treating one another just as we'd like to be treated in return. Most of us are already aware of this at one level. There's the old Indian proverb which warns of condemning another individual until we've been allowed to walk in their moccasins. And the Bible makes it clear that each of us merely reaps what we have sown. But sometimes these principles are easy to forget because we get so caught up in the busyness and demands of our daily activities. In one respect, the only purpose for life is to work on our relationships with others. The job we find ourselves in, the school we're attending, the neighborhood we just happen to find, are just places where we can work on genuine soul growth. One of the interesting things about reincarnation is that talents and skills are never lost. Someone who has developed an ability in one life will still have it to draw upon later. For example, many child prodigies with a talent, let's say for music, are born with a conscious recollection of an ability that was developed earlier. If a person happens to be an excellent English teacher in this life, they may have been a playwright in the last, a historian before that, and perhaps even a scribe earlier. A person's abilities are channeled in those directions which will best help them fulfill their purpose for a particular lifetime. These talents and abilities, as well as faults that need to be overcome, can be called karma. What is karma? It's memory in action. Those memories are sometimes conscious, but more often are unconscious soul memories which still deeply influence us in our current lifetime. Each of us has certain challenges and opportunities that we face in life because of this memory. But because we possess individual free will, we can meet these challenges as positive or negative experiences. For example, suppose there's a person in your family whom you really don't like, and that person doesn't seem to care for you. Perhaps you were rivals or antagonists in a past incarnation. There is karma or memory between you, but with free will, the opportunity for the two of you in the relationship becomes one in which you forgive one another for something that occurred in the past, and you learn to love each other once again. Even if the two of you cannot consciously remember any details of a troubled past life together, learning to forgive and love each other in the present can heal that unconscious memory. Karma provides us with a lesson we need to learn in order to grow, and with our free will, we decide whether or not we're going to learn it. How widespread is a belief in reincarnation? It is accepted in most places in the Eastern world, a central teaching of religions like Hinduism and Buddhism. But how does the concept fit into conventional Judeo-Christian thought? For the Christian, there is the opportunity to meet life's challenges in Jesus, and thereby let grace enter our lives instead of simply karma. For the Jew, there is the chance to call upon the God of our forefathers and accept that grace. Remember, karma is simply memory in action and the way we respond to circumstances in our lives based on that memory. We have the opportunity to do it with help from on high. Sometimes that graceful way of healing a karmic memory comes through prayer. Other times it may come through serving other people who have a related karmic problem of their own. With free will, the choice is ours. Our true identity rests within the mind and soul, and not the flesh. We are not physical bodies with souls, but are instead souls who at the moment happen to be in the material world. The readings affirm the fact that when a physical body dies, the individual goes on living. Life is an eternal experience. Remember in the Bible in Genesis, souls were created in God's image before the creation of physical bodies. We were with God in the beginning, and that is where we are again headed now. One Edgar Casey reading says, quote, "Then, as there has been and in the passage of a soul through time and space, through this and that experience, it has been and is for the purpose of giving more and more opportunities to express that which justifies man in his relationships one with another, in mercy, love, patience, long-suffering, brotherly love." Unquote. Reincarnation, then, is a concept that can encompass not only Eastern thought, but all of the major religions of the world. It's a concept that can allow us to have more compassion one for another. It's a way we can begin to look at all facets of life purposefully. However, it doesn't really matter if another individual believes or doubts the theory of rebirth. For some, it can be a helpful concept. For others, confusing. The reason for believing in reincarnation is not so that we can dwell upon the past or brag about the possibility of having been a famous person. The wisest student of reincarnation knows that we have all had incarnations in lowly and lofty circumstances. But the real reason, the most helpful purpose for believing, is summed up in Casey's own words. Quote, "In the studies, then, know where you are going, to find that ye have lived, died, and were buried under the cherry tree in grandmother's garden does not make thee one whit a better neighbor, citizen, mother, or father. But to know that ye spoke unkindly and suffered for it, and in the present may correct it by being righteous, that is worthwhile." Unquote. If we can think for a moment about the one person in our life whom we love most of all, then we will get an inkling of the goal of reincarnation, for that is to be able to love every single soul, even ourselves, with the very same love. Approximately 1,000 of Casey's readings deal with the subject of dreams and dream interpretation. Perhaps the most important insights gained from the wealth of this material is the fact that each of us is aware of much more about ourselves, our physical bodies, our surroundings, even our lifestyles at subconscious levels than we realize when we're awake. During the early part of this century, while analysts such as Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung were demonstrating the clinical importance of dreams, Edgar Cayce was providing average individuals with guidelines to what's become one of the most practical approaches to working with dreams. Whether we have an interest in dreams as a researcher or simply want to discuss them with family members over breakfast, the Cayce material emphasizes the almost limitless wealth of information that can become available to us in the dream state. Through this dream state, we open up our minds to many different levels of our own unconscious. Not only are all of our previous conscious experiences stored in the subconscious, but it is also the storehouse of mind resources which rarely come to conscious awareness. The subconscious has remarkable talents for finding solutions to problems. It also houses all of our wishes, hopes, and memories of past experiences. The subconscious can assist us with self-examination and provide practical guidance. It even makes possible for us to have personal psychic experiences. Dreams can diagnose the causes of our physical ailments. They can point out the thoughts and emotions that we've tried to overlook. And dreams often make suggestions for improving our relationships with other people. While dreaming, we can gain awareness about our entire being, physically, mentally, and spiritually. It was Carl Jung, a Swiss psychiatrist and contemporary of Edgar Cayce, who found convincing evidence for a deep level to the unconscious mind. This profound depth, Jung felt, came from genuine spiritual reality and hadn't been acknowledged by Freud. Jung called this level the collective unconscious. Here, all minds can communicate through the use of universal symbols, images which seem to have a common meaning among people all over the world. For example, a symbol such as a lion or a great cat has a universal or archetypal meaning of power or vitality. Birds frequently symbolize various kinds of love or concern. Water is often suggestive of the spirit itself. Myths or fairy tales often have similarities between cultures, and these similarities are shown through universal symbols and themes. Sometimes our own dreams contain these kinds of symbols. Of course, not all the symbols and images in our dreams can be interpreted as universal or archetypal. Many, if not most, symbols are best interpreted by finding the personal associations one has with that person or object. The dream symbol of a rifle would likely mean one thing to a gunsmith and something quite different to a war victim. There is no such thing as a bad dream, because all dreams have the potential to help the dreamer. Dreams of disastrous events may simply be advice to change our diets, our attitudes, or they may simply be releases from emotional aspects of our lives. They can become invaluable tools in instruction and guidance if we would only begin to work with them. For example, one person who dreamed of a headless man in uniform was told in their Cayce reading that instead of losing their head over their duties by following the letter of the law and getting too caught up in their job, there was a greater lesson to be learned by following the spirit. A person who dreamed of a wild man running through the streets, shouting and causing a great deal of trouble, was told that the dream was advice for them to control their own temper. One lady dreamed that a friend of hers was speaking to her. She noticed that the woman had beautiful false teeth of different shapes, where every other one had the appearance of pure gold. She was told that the gold teeth represented the spiritual truths of which she herself was often speaking, but they were false because she hadn't applied in her own life what she was preaching. Another woman dreamed that her mother, who had died, was alive and happy. Cayce assured her that she was not trying to fool herself, that her mother was indeed alive and happy. He said, quote, "For there is no death, only a transition from the physical to the spiritual plane. Birth into the physical plane is referred to as a new life. Birth into the spiritual is the beginning also of a new experience." Unquote. In trying to arrive at a dream interpretation, one possibility to consider is that the dream is largely literal. For example, seeing yourself eat a salad in the dream may indicate the need for a change in your diet. In other cases, the action is more symbolic of what is happening in waking life. Dreaming about different rooms which you haven't yet explored could be pointing to the unopened doors of your own personality. A car often symbolizes the physical body and the need to make a change or correct a physical condition. On the other hand, dreams of birth and death are more often symbolic as they point to new beginnings and perhaps the end of doing things the old way. In other words, a dream death is often the death of a part of your personality. For example, a woman who dreams of attending the funeral for her minister's wife may be allowing the spiritual aspect of her own life to be overlooked or laid to rest. Dreams of being pregnant or taking care of a small child, which you really don't have in the waking state, aren't necessarily a literal prediction. The dream could merely be pointing out a new condition which will be coming your way, or a new idea to which you will soon give birth. When dreams give guidance or seem to pass judgments, it is usually in response to values and ideals we have previously set for ourselves. Most dreams can be seen as a kind of comparison. Casey used the word correlation. While we sleep, a comparison is made between recent actions and the inner values we hold. As you look at what's going on in your life, and then look at a particular dream, you'll begin to have an idea of what individual symbols may mean, especially if the symbol repeats itself in later dreams. The symbol won't necessarily mean the same thing to you as it means to someone else, because dreams are as individual as the dreamer. The purpose of dreams is to make us more consciously aware of where we are going in our lives based on our thoughts, feelings, and action. They can show us the desires that are motivating us. They can help us sense the needs of our bodies. They can provide insights for living life more creatively. They can assist us in making important decisions based on what we already know at a conscious level. For example, they may give guidance for helping to heal a relationship, but only if we've already tried to do the best we can with that person. We set our sights, make the decisions that are called for, and dreams will aid us by bringing life into clearer focus. Working with our dreams can be like speaking with a trusted friend who knows everything about us and is just there to discuss what's going on in our life. Most of the time, they'll just listen. But in their listening, we can begin to find answers within our own self. The answers have been there all the time. We just never knew how to look for them. The next subject we'll be looking at is extrasensory perception, ESP. Basically, ESP refers to the ability to receive or send information in ways not normally associated with our five senses. In simplest terms, it is really a method of communicating with one another without using sight, sound, taste, smell, or touch. And according to the Casey readings, it is a method that each of us can use and develop. The story of Edgar Casey's life is filled with examples of what this extra sense of communication is like. His entire ability to lie down and give readings in the sleep state could be labeled ESP, because he somehow knew information that he had never studied, and he could see people and places and things without using his physical sight. While asleep, he could answer questions on any topic, or he could give descriptions of his patients and their surroundings, even though Casey was in Virginia Beach and his patient might be in California. Because there are so many different types of extrasensory communication, researchers have broken the term ESP down into further categories to help explain what is taking place. One of these categories is called telepathy, which is also known as mind-to-mind communication. This is the ability to obtain information psychically by reading the mind of another person. For example, while Casey was in Kentucky, he gave a reading for a man in New York. He saw the man smoking a cigar, heard him whistling a particular song, saw him meet with another man about a piece of property, and then look over three letters. finally, the sleeping Casey heard the man telephone another gentleman, and he knew the gentleman's name. All of these events were later verified. Casey was able to see with this extra sense everything his patient in New York had experienced firsthand with normal senses. Another category of ESP is clairvoyance, which is the ability to have information that no one else has. Looking at one instance from the Casey readings, a patient was in Ohio while Edgar Casey was in Virginia Beach. While in the state from which he gave readings, Casey correctly gave the patient's body temperature. Now, if the attending doctor in Ohio had known the patient's temperature before Casey's reading was given, then this would be an example of telepathy. But if the doctor hadn't known the temperature until after Casey's psychic reading, it would be an example of clairvoyance. A third category of ESP is precognition, which is the ability to see events before they happen. Many of us have had the same experience, which we call déjà vu. The Casey readings suggest that one explanation for this phenomenon is that our dreams often foreshadow future events. Such precognitive dreams may be forgotten and only dimly felt as déjà vu experiences. There are countless examples of precognition in the files of the Edgar Casey material. When completing a reading for a woman in New York, he suddenly started giving a reading for a woman in Missouri, although no one had asked him to. Her request for help did not arrive until after his response had been mailed. Her letter requesting the reading was dated the day after he had volunteered the information. Casey predicted the stock market crash 4.5 years before it occurred. He also foresaw the start of World War II, and he knew that he would die before his two sons returned home from overseas. Although some individuals have called Casey a prophet, he himself made no such claims. In fact, in one reading, he described himself as, quote, a weak, lowly, unworthy channel, unquote. He rarely made any predictions about worldwide events, mostly because these kind of predictions are subject to countless outside influences. For example, when a psychic tries to predict the future, all they can actually do is predict a possible future based on current happenings. If things continue on the same course, if people's attitudes, lifestyles, and world events remain the same, then a psychic can see what the result will be. However, the readings make it quite clear that each of us has the gift of free will, and if enough people change what they are currently doing with their free will, this in turn will have dramatic effects on the future. The ability of precognition, then, is subject to many more influences than either telepathy or clairvoyance. The fourth major category of ESP shown in the Edgar Casey readings is retrocognition, which is the ability to see past events. For example, in the life readings, Casey would often repeat aloud significant happenings in a person's life while going back over the years until the date of the person's birth. In one reading, Casey was given the incorrect date and location of birth for a young girl. In going back over the years, he responded with, "We don't find it here." He'd been told that the girl was born on January 24, 1919, in Cleveland, Ohio. Then, after a short pause, he finally said, quote, "Yes, we have the record here. Looks like it's the wrong place and date," unquote. It was later discovered that the girl had been born on the 23rd of January, a day early, in New York, and not Cleveland. More than 11 years before the Dead Sea Scrolls were found in 1947, Casey's readings described a sect of Judaism which scholars knew little about. This group was the Essenes, and Casey gave a great deal of information about their work and their lives in the community. For example, he claimed that in the Essene society, men and women worked and lived together. At the time of the reading, scholars believed that the Essenes were a society of exclusively men. However, in 1951, more than 6 years after Casey's death, archaeologists made further excavations at Qumran, near the site where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. They discovered evidence that both men and women lived together in the Essene society. Casey claimed that everyone was psychic, to some degree, because psychic ability was a natural ability of the soul. Like any other talent, it might take training to awaken it, and it would probably manifest in different ways for different people. Just as one person's musical ability expresses itself through voice, and another person's through piano or violin. Our final topic from the readings is meditation. It's interesting to note that Edgar Casey began recommending meditation as early as 1921, long before many people even knew what it was. By practicing this method of becoming silent, individuals can reduce their anxiety levels and learn to become more relaxed. Many physicians now recommend meditation as an effective way for individuals to help lower their blood pressure. In fact, certain hospitals throughout the country have begun to offer meditation classes to their patients. The simplest definition of meditation is the practice of quieting our physical bodies and our minds and focusing our attention inward instead of on the world around us. Meditation promotes coordination at three levels. Physically, we begin to relax. Mentally, our busy thoughts become quiet. And spiritually, we become re-energized and are able to deal more lovingly and effectively with the people and events around us. In one respect, prayer is like talking to God, but meditation is like listening to that portion of our being which is in constant communication with the divine. Remember that according to the Edgar Casey readings, we're not merely physical bodies with souls, but are instead souls who happen to be in the physical world. By following a few simple steps, anyone can have a period of meditation, and even a beginner can experience the calming effects of a few moments of purposeful silence. The Casey material suggests a number of preparatory measures we can work with before beginning our meditation period. On a physical level, cleanliness of both our bodies and our surroundings is important. We may also wish to incorporate music or additional relaxation exercises into the period just before we begin the silence period. Mentally, we might want to start working on forgiving those we're having difficulties with, such as through prayer before the meditation. As we become quiet, in a comfortable position, we can let go of those petty thoughts and feelings which hinder our capacity to feel spiritual realities. If you would like to try to meditate, the first step is to get into a comfortable position. It's probably best to sit in a chair, keeping your spine straight, your feet flat on the floor, and your eyes closed. Find a comfortable position for your hands, either in your lap or at your sides. Slowly, take a few deep breaths and begin to relax. Breathe the air deep into your lungs. Hold it for a moment, and then slowly breathe it out. With your mind, search your body for any obvious tension or tight muscles. You can try and relieve the tension by deep breathing, imagining the area is relaxed, or gently massaging any tightness with your fingertips. When you have finished this preparation, then you are ready to move on to the next stage. The second step is to begin to focus your mind on one single, peaceful, calming thought. Instead of thinking about what went on at work today, or what has to be done after listening to this cassette, try focusing on a thought such as, I am relaxed, or I will be still and feel at peace. You could also use a biblical verse or a thought with a spiritual focus such as, God is love. These thoughts are also called affirmations. The first way to work with the affirmation is to try to clear your mind of everything else. Then, think about the words of the affirmation until they become merged into a single feeling. For example, you should be able to get a sense of what the feeling is behind the words, and it is this feeling you want to hold in your mind. The third step is to hold the feeling in silent attention without needing the words of the affirmation. Gently bring your focus back to the words of the affirmation every time your mind begins to wander. That is to say, first begin thinking of the words of the affirmation, and then try and concentrate on the feeling behind them. Don't let yourself become discouraged when you find yourself thinking more about distractions when you're focusing on the affirmation. It'll take time to teach yourself to be able to think about only one thought. Spend anywhere from 3 minutes to 15 minutes trying to hold the affirmation silently. These longer meditation periods are for when you've built up some experience. The fourth step is to send out good thoughts or prayers to other people when you feel your meditation time is coming to an end. If you've been focusing on peace, then try and send a sense of that peace to someone whom you're concerned about. As you begin to practice meditation daily, each of these four steps may become easier, and you might also notice that the sense of peace inside of you during meditation will begin to carry over into different parts of your day. Casey's approach to meditation differs from that of some schools of thought, which contend that the mind gets in the way of the meditator, and so the mind should be blanked out. The readings suggest that mind is a constructive force and allows for the closest attunement possible, if used right. From the standpoint of the Edgar Casey readings, the most important relationship each one of us has is the one with God. One of the most beneficial ways we can do this is through the regular practice of meditation. For this reason, the readings suggest that meditation is something that every soul should learn to do. Throughout his life, Edgar Casey claimed no special abilities, nor did he ever consider himself to be some kind of 20th century prophet. The readings never offered a set of beliefs that had to be embraced, but instead focused on the fact that each person should test in his or her own life the principles presented. Only those that show good fruits are worth believing in. Though Casey himself was a Christian and read the Bible from cover to cover every year of his life, his work was one which stressed the importance of comparative study between belief systems all over the world. The underlying principle of the readings is the oneness of all life, tolerance for all people, and an understanding for every major religion of the world. It's interesting to note that in the 43 years readings were being given, Casey never heard a word he said in the sleep state, nor remembered it when he woke up. To understand the nature of his own work, he spent many long hours looking over the information in the readings that had been written down by his secretary, Gladys Davis. His story is really that of a simple photographer who, despite a great deal of reluctance and humility, went on to become one of the most helpful psychics the world has ever known. The information in the readings, available to us today, is his gift to the world. Thank you.